the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's December 2023, and you're listening to episode 369, which is a conversation about the history of Planned Parenthood. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., an organization founded to equip Christians and pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written an in-depth online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called The Roots of Planned Parenthood, and you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. Jay, it's good to have you back on the podcast.
It's great to be back, as always.
Well, this is a very interesting, fascinating topic to me, specifically because next year is a presidential election, and of course, abortion has been in the news for the last couple of years, but it continues to be covered by mainstream media outlets, which is interesting because in the past, people didn't talk about it as much. But just because everything that Jay and I have covered regarding Roe v. Wade and the aftermath of that, and even before that, it seems to have just a renewed interest more than ever since the decision in the 1970s. And so this article is going to be one that goes over the history of Planned Parenthood and its roots and its philosophies. And one thing is, you know, they're a big abortion provider, which is why we wanted to find out a little bit more about them. Our listeners might want to know, if they are newer to this podcast, that we have a written article that we did many years ago on Planned Parenthood's founder, Margaret Sanger, and that will be linked in the show notes. But just to get going, Jay, I'm sure most people vaguely, you know Planned Parenthood. They do a lot of marketing. They have heard about them. But what is Planned Parenthood?
Planned Parenthood advertises themselves or declares themselves the nation's number one provider for sexual health. They see themselves as an organization that is intended to, by their philosophy, attend to the sexual health and wellness needs of the United States and then beyond that with Planned Parenthood International. And so they provide the type of things they provide to people in the community would be contraceptive care and the sense of contraception offered for free in most places, but you do have to pay for certain services from them and that side of things. But they are the number one single abortion provider in the United States. It's interesting as you try to look through and get to that number, how you establish that, because it's a thing that people say a lot. But when I was footnoting it for the article, it was interesting to me how hard it was to find somebody who broke down those numbers. So how it comes out to is that they provide something close now, as abortion numbers nationally have gone down and their numbers are going up, where they provide something like 374,000 abortions last year, over 970,000 total throughout the country. They're up to like 41% of all abortions in the country. So they see themselves, and we talked about in the article, they have moved into over the last couple of decades, but increasingly more hormone therapy for the trans community. They see themselves as a place where the way that they talk about themselves is that they deal with the things that are stigmatized with courage. They provide information that other people are afraid to. They talk about things in a bold way. They're very good at tailoring information towards young people and towards children. Videos, they're on TikTok, they're on Snapchat, they're on YouTube, they're on Instagram. They are everywhere communicating a particular message of sexual well-being that, you know, I think they sound good. Here's an interesting point to me as far as the power of Planned Parenthood's messaging. Many years ago, the facility where I worked, the pregnancy care center where I worked for 3 years as a development coordinator, and I'm now the chairperson of the board. It's the largest one in the state of Georgia as far as the number of people that we see and talk to. The woman that was the executive director went to pastors all over the city of Atlanta. And they said, if you had somebody who came to you who was pregnant or was dealing with a crisis pregnancy, where would you send them? Who would you call for help? And almost all of the pastors said Planned Parenthood. because they have so monopolized this area and the public mind that they almost are the lone representative or either of the abortion industry or this idea of family planning. Who do I go to learn about sex? Where do I go to learn about my options? For most of the people who don't have a deeper understanding of what's going on at Planned Parenthood, they seem like a good thing. Even Christians, by the way, there are Christians who have argued, well, they offer really good services. We can't get distracted by the idea of their relationship to abortion because that's just one of the things that they do. They offer all of these really helpful services. That's the marketing that they've been able to do to communicate to the world around them that we are here for all of your sexual health and wellness needs, including abortion, which ends up being financially a huge part of the organization.
So one thing, you know, you just mentioned that they just have a lot of influence due to their marketing, but at the same time, they can be a divisive organization in our culture. So I'd like to know why that is. And also you mentioned that they are actually targets of sting operations or those kinds of things. And there's been a lot of attempts to cut off their funding. So why don't you explain some of those things to us and why there's so much, you know, conflict over Planned Parenthood?
If you only know a little bit about Planned Parenthood, they can seem or appear like a good thing. But if you understand how committed they are to the cause of abortion, and then obviously understand, as almost everybody who's been awake for the last several decades understands, this is the most divisive issue politically and even personally in the light that the world has faced in public policy in the United States, certainly sustained over decades and elections and Supreme Court nominations and charitable giving and all of these areas, because Planned Parenthood is the number one provider of abortion. They're the number one lobbyer. As far as you look at the numbers, that the money that they spend is $800 million or something like that on the amount of money that they have spent over years lobbying for or fighting for the rights of people to get abortion, access to abortion, the amount of money they've made through abortion is because they pay or charge for abortion services that they offer. If you love abortion or if you like abortion or you support abortion, then Planned Parenthood is a heroic institution in the culture. They're out there fighting for your rights. They're out there on the front lines. They're out there educating people about the importance of abortion as healthcare. They have fought hard to make the case that abortion is fundamental healthcare for women. If you believe that the unborn are human, and they're one of us, which is the way that I like to start the conversation, are the unborn one of us? If you believe that they are one of us, and then as a Christian, what I understand one of us is an image bearer of God. If I understand that all human beings are intrinsically valuable by virtue of being a human being, if I'm looking for a place to ground this concept of intrinsic dignity, of intrinsic value, of intrinsic worth, I have to find it grounded in a place where we all equally share some particular trait or characteristic. And the only thing that every human being on this earth shares equally is our shared humanity. So if I start from there, that human beings are valuable by virtue of what they are, and that we're human from the moment that we come into existence, and that the unborn are one of us, and that we are the image bearers of God, then it's inescapably true that the largest single destroyer of human life in the United States is the largest abortion provider, the largest single abortion provider in the United States, which is Planned Parenthood. And so we're looking at an institution where if you have a particular view of abortion, you think they're heroic. If you have a particular view of abortion, then they're monstrous. And there's very little in between, right? I mean, and one of the things to talk about in the article is when we talk about, I talk to individuals a lot, and I teach people how to talk to individuals. And anytime we have an individual discussion about the issue of abortion, I try to teach people to be very respectful. Be very respectful when you're having a conversation with this person. Do your best to honor the person in front of you, to treat them with the same dignity that we're talking about all human life ought to be treated with. But Planned Parenthood is an institution. They're not an individual. And institutions can be irredeemably corrupt by their very nature. If an institution exists to pursue evil ends, then I don't have to worry about being polite to the institution. I need to be polite to an individual that I'm talking to. I need to treat them with respect, but I don't have to treat an institution as if it's something that could be redeemed. And Planned Parenthood if you have a high value of human life, if you have a traditional Christian view of what it means to be a human being, if you think the unborn are one of us, it's just a monstrous organization dedicated to destroying human life at a level higher than anybody else in the United States. And having fought for that right for decades now, out there on the front lines, doing everything that they can to make certain they still have the continued right to charge people to destroy their children before they're born. So they're divisive by their very nature because they center most powerfully on this particular issue. And then in this particular issue, the unborn either are one of us or they are not. The destruction of them is either like something like a tooth extraction, as Greg Coca would say, or it is the destruction of an innocent human life. And so there is very little middle ground there. And so they bring out, for anybody who is passionate about these issues, and a large number of people in the society are, increasing number of them are, they bring out passionate feelings because they represent an extreme. They are the face of abortion in the United States. If you care about that at all, then they become the group that is going to draw the most attention. The sting operations that you mentioned, the live action went in, this is when Lila Rose in live action are first getting started, went in as a student at UCLA, a student journalist at UCLA. And she and James O'Keefe went in and they pretended to be a 23-year-old and a 15-year-old seeking an abortion. And they were given advice from the people in Planned Parenthood about how to speak to the people in Planned Parenthood so that it wouldn't be obviously statutory rape and that we wouldn't be looking at a sexual abuse case. So they're advising them on how to talk in a way to keep them from getting in trouble and so they could acquire the services they wanted to acquire. They went later and did some in 2011, that original, I think like 2007, went back in 2011 and did further sting operations where they had recorded conversations where it appeared that people from Planned Parenthood were helping them to cover up sex trafficking. There have been sting operations by Center for Medical Progress, where David DeLayden's group went in and they were trying to procure abortion, the bodies of children who'd been destroyed through abortion for research purposes and trying to buy them at a profit to Planned Parenthood, which is illegal. And they seemed to indicate that Planned Parenthood was in that market. And each one of these cases, by the way, Planned Parenthood successfully defended themselves from efforts to defund them as a result of what had happened. But their defenses were very rarely, oh, it didn't happen. It was that, oh, this was selectively edited. We after the fact went back and reported things. We have made changes since then. With the Center for Medical Progress thing, they said, oh, well, some of our affiliates do donate tissue to third parties for research, but it's not done as a profit and it's standard and legal the way that we're doing it. So they're not saying, no, we don't ever donate the remains of human beings for research. They're saying the way that we do it doesn't profit us. We just cover our expenses. Or they're not saying that our people didn't say those things. They're saying they said those things to make those people comfortable so that we could report them later. There's a constant desire to shut them down by people who see them as a destroyer by nature, as far as what they pursue, the aims that they pursue as an institution. And then each one of these like discrete episodes of stings were opportunities to try to rally the public support necessary to be able to take their public funding away. At least we're never going to take their private funding. They're 501c3. Anybody can give private donations to them. And by the way, anytime anyone tries to take their public funding, their private donations go through the roof. They're an incredibly well-funded organization. And the mechanism that they've put together to defend them, both legally and in the culture, is a powerful mechanism. So they are able to defeat these things, even when there's further evidence. Like they can disparage live action or Center for Medical Progress. But in the article, I point to academic articles, one that's looking at the physical consequences of sex trafficking. And they interview women who have come out of sex trafficking of various ages. And they said something about 30%, close to 30% of the women who had endured years of sex trafficking had contact with Planned Parenthood while they were being trafficked. And these women were talking about having forced abortions or going there for treatment for STD use. And 30% of these women had been into a Planned Parenthood and come out of a Planned Parenthood while they were being sex trafficked. And there was no effort to rescue them. As far as we can tell, there was nothing done. They were given the services that were asked for by the men that were trafficking them. So the question is, and one of the things I talk about is, how does Planned Parenthood, when they keep saying this never happened, this never happened, this never happened, and we see growing evidence that things like this do happen, even recently, very recently, a young woman was out of Idaho because abortion was illegal in Idaho, was taken into Oregon to a Planned Parenthood facility in Bend, Oregon. She's a 15-year-old. She was taken by her 18-year-old boyfriend and his mother without the consent or knowledge of her family. So she was taken across state lines and convinced not to talk to her family about it, taken to a Planned Parenthood and offered an abortion. The 18-year-old and the mom are now being charged with kidnapping because they took a minor across the border without a parent's consent to have a medical procedure performed on them. And these are the kind of things when you prioritize performing abortions versus the context of what the person in front of you is there for. When you're heir to the side of give the service, heir to the side of perform the abortion, you are put in a place where it's kind of difficult for Planned Parenthood to be able to serve that desire to offer abortions and to watch out for the abuses that that is creating within our culture.
Well, one thing that you mentioned was their ability to fundraise, even if they had some public funding at some times threatened to be cut off. And I just wanted to give our listeners kind of a scope of the financial situation of Planned Parenthood based on figures from 2022, which is last year. They're the 30th largest charity in the United States, and their total revenue is $1.7 billion. That's a lot of money. They have government support of $633 million, and then almost as much in private donations, $579 million. And then they get another $500 million from other income that they have. I don't know if that's their services and those kinds of things that they do, but their net assets are $2.1 billion. That is a huge nonprofit organization.
Yeah, they're massive. And the number, it's amazing how anytime there's a threat to them, they're able to turn that threat into a fund. And this is true of a lot of nonprofits, that the crisis raises money, right? So when they are confronted with a crisis of a growing unease from particular sectors of the United States with what we see them doing, when these things come out and these videos come out and you hear people from Planned Parenthood talking these ways, the immediate response by their supporters is always to give them money. They do their best financially when they look like they are most at risk. At the moment that all these friends of mine who work in this area are trying and believing that they're finally at the place where they're going to be able to undermine the power of Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood comes out with more money than they ever had before.
Yes, they're extremely well funded. Well, let's talk a little bit more about their foundations, how they were founded. And I mentioned earlier to our listeners that years ago, we published an article about the founder, Margaret Sanger, and it's called No Gods, No Masters. Margaret Sanger, No Gods, No Masters, and you can look it up on our website, equip.org. It's free to read there. Margaret Sanger was born in 1879. She died in 1966, and actually, she was a feminist, obviously, and she was an advocate for underprivileged women in lower income areas, based on, you know, just some of her own personal experience. And she really wanted to, actually give them an alternative to abortion at the time, way back then at the beginning of the 20th century, by providing them birth control. And so she opened the very first birth control clinic in America in 1916. So what was the early days of the organization of Planned Parenthood back in those days where she herself didn't, you know, wasn't trying to promote abortion? She was just trying to provide birth control to help really women in lower economic situations and more like in living in the inner city, those kinds of women, you know, access to birth control.
Yeah. The first operations then, before it had any name, I mean, the first name, that would be like 1923, the American Birth Control League. That would happen years later. In 1916, and there was the Comstock laws against obscenity, and talking about birth control would violate those. So she would disseminate information, basically, you know, for the point of being arrested and drawing attention. And also she would send people diaphragms through the mail. When you think about birth control at that point, this is way prior to the invention of the birth control pill. So the type of the birth control that we're talking with, largely diaphragms, pessaries, things of that nature. And so she would send diaphragms to people through the mail. She would talk to people about ways to not get pregnant. Now, it's interesting. You talk about the idea that there was an obvious a passion for what happened because her mother died very young from having to given so many births. And she blamed her father for that, for keeping her pregnant throughout her lifetime. And she saw other women dying when she was working in poverty. But her response to that wasn't entirely pure. You wouldn't, I mean, in the sense, I've heard people talk about the stories and say she saw these things and her response was, we have to help these people to not be burdened any longer with this constant state of pregnancy that is destroying their bodies, which I could, you can understand anyone who saw what she saw having that response. Her early work is somehow folded up at the time of a philosophy or a view of human life that existed at that moment, coming off of the sort of Darwinian wave. It's where they, if you look back at that, the approach of Darwinian approach to things and natural selection, and that's overtook a lot of different views. Everybody was trying to take that scientific view into the way that they understood different concepts of humanities. And so they put it into this sort of sociological idea. And so eugenicists in the early 20th century in the United States, it's a terrible chapter of eugenics. And it was, I mean, some of our most beloved American figures like Teddy Roosevelt are wrapped up into this idea. Some of these of using this concept of eugenics. So this idea was spreading that we had to control the number of births in the population that we see less desirable, because the less desirable elements, the less educated, the not gainfully employed, they seem to be having more kids than anybody else. And the people we want to have kids are not having enough kids. And so we have to introduce a way to control them. So as the birth control movement is starting, it is mixed in with the eugenics movement. And so this has been a trouble of understanding Margaret Sanger's motivations for years, because in her operations, she works alongside some unsavory people, to put it mildly, with very, very evil aims. And she somehow, while working with them and herself saying some terrible things and participating in some terrible things, enjoyed this cover, this moral cover, for decades, that she was pure of heart, seeking to help the poor, but living in a certain political reality that required her to work with these unsavory elements in the eugenics movement. These people who, they wanted birth control because they wanted to control the births of the less desirable populations. They wanted them having fewer kids and the right people having more kids. So at the outset, she is and writes that she is driven by this desire to help these people that are burdened by this way of living that has existed, and that family planning and controlling birth can help that happen. But even mixed in her own talking about it, the way the language that she uses, she's often not just, because that's what I taught in an interview I did many, many years ago with another organization where they said, was she racist? And I said, I think racist is too limited a term. Margaret Sanger didn't like whole classes of people and believed that they should not be allowed to breed, and that the world would be better off if they were separated from the better classes so that they could live out in a place where their multiplication was controlled, where they wouldn't impact society. She just had a nasty view of her fellow human beings sometimes that was expressed in her work and her writing. But at that early stage, it was just an office where she offered things and got arrested, and where she was this firebrand. She was known as a great public speaker. She was very charismatic and she could rally people to her cause. And so she was looking for conflict. She sought conflict out. She wanted to take on the Comstock laws. She wanted to take on the people that were arresting her. She wanted the opportunity to speak publicly, to make her case that that birth control was good for society.
Well, you know, our article on Margaret Sanger was published in 2010, which obviously is 13 years ago. And, you know, there were a lot of years that Planned Parenthood and all of their supporters really defended Margaret Sanger's views and the charges that she was a racist and was involved, as you just mentioned, in holding to a Darwinian worldview and involved in actual eugenics. But somehow this all changed, you know, in 2021. I was so surprised when I saw the op-ed at the time by the new president of Planned Parenthood, who basically canceled Margaret Sanger. I don't know that I ever expected to see someone cancel Margaret Sanger, especially the president of Planned Parenthood. So what was happening there, and why are they changing their tune, and what are they saying that she's guilty of?
Well, I think when we're talking about the President Alexis McGill Johnson, the newest president, the current president of Planned Parenthood, she's a woman of color. You know, during the Black Lives Matters movement, there was a lot of pushback from conservatives saying you're canceling all of these people and yet you're not dealing with Margaret Sanger. And I think in that sense, you have to give Alexis McGill Johnson credit. I mean, she comes in, she becomes the head of Planned Parenthood. The first signs of this, by the way, was when they announced that they were going to change the name of their New York Planned Parenthood office from the Margaret, they're taking Margaret Sanger's name away from it. And then she comes out and she says, I'm done supporting, and that New York Times op-ed, we're done defending Margaret Sanger. I think, so at that point, as the reevaluation of sort of all of these different people in our collective memory and history, that we want to look at these things that they have done, she just gets honest and says, we can be Planned Parenthood, the Planned Parenthood that we want to be, without any longer defending what is indefensible. And she lists off the things that can't be defended, right? She lists off that she worked with and alongside eugenicists. She went to, and this goes over, these offenses go over courses of years, right? From the very beginning, she's working with eugenicists. But in 1923, when they open up the American Birth Control League, they're actually operating out of the office of, I think it's the American Eugenics Society. But I mean, the biggest American eugenics group in New York is giving them office space so that they can start up. That's how cozy they were. On her original board of directors was a guy by the name of Lothrop Stoddard. Lothrop Stoddard was one of the most outspoken racist of his time. He wrote a book called Untermensch. It was the Nazis that took from Lothrop Stoddard the term Untermensch, like subhuman, that is most often associated with Nazis, and the Nazis loved it. They got that from Lothrop Stoddard. Lothrop Stoddard sat on her original board of directors for the American Birth Control League. That's 1923. That's not 1916 when it first starts. So as she, and I've started a 501c3, I know how important it is to pick your board of directors, particularly your initial board of directors. You don't invite people on that you don't know who they are and they don't have some contribution to make. So you see from the outset, this cooperation, she's in 1925, I think it is, she goes to a women's auxiliary Ku Klux Klan meeting to rally support for her cause. These are not things that you would tolerate from anybody in the modern world and say that, oh, they were just good people that were caught up in a bad moment. She supported, and by the way, Planned Parenthood acknowledges as well. You can find this on their website. She supported the 1927 Buck versus Bell decision of the Supreme Court that said that certain people should be allowed to be forcibly sterilized against their will, which ultimately leads to something around 36 to 37,000 Americans over the course of the next 10 years or so being sterilized against their will. A lot of it happening in very particular states. But Margaret Sanger said, hey, that's a great idea, right? So, and then getting to other things later on that she mentions, but she mentions all of these offenses in her article saying, look, these are indefensible. We've spent time defending them because we wanted to be able to say that they wanted to be able to celebrate the first 100 years of Planned Parenthood. But you can't celebrate the first 100 years of Planned Parenthood unless you overlook some of the detestable qualities that Margaret Sanger, their founder and a woman who's been held up for now a century as a hero to their cause, who was involved in some pretty disgusting and shady things and involving some pretty nasty people in her movement and working with these people after some pretty nasty aims and occasionally saying some pretty and writing some pretty nasty things. So for decades, they're trying to cover that up. But Alexis McGill Johnson shows up and says, you know, to be modern Planned Parenthood, we don't have to defend this because it just doesn't make sense. This is one of the things that has always driven me crazy. You have two options with Margaret Sanger. You either believe she was a good person who was working in a corrupt system and doing her very best to navigate it to reach good quality ends. That would be the optimistic view of her. Or you just embrace that she was what she was, which was one of them. she was racist like they were racist. She was eugenics like eugenicist like they were eugenicists. That the world that she lived in, the circles that she ran in, the things that the people that she believed that she associated with, she was one of them. Now, she may have had moments where she voiced views that were less intense than theirs, but all throughout her career, you see evidence that she believed what they believed and acted in accordance with those things, not that she was a woman who was trying her best to navigate a corrupt system. And I mean, hey, kudos to Alexis McGill Johnson for finally coming out. And it gets it off the table, by the way. I mean, and they mentioned that if you read it, for years that they have been trying to defend themselves against this, just get it out. Just get her out of it. There's no reason to waste your time defending that. When you operate, that's good leadership. I will say that for somebody who's running an organization I don't like, that's quality leadership. Because I've talked to leaderships of other organizations when they're talking about someone in their organization coming under attack fairly, that they've done something wrong. And they tell me, what do I do? Defend them. It's like, is that what you want to do now for the rest of your life? Do you want your organization to have your normal mission and then defend this person? And that's what Planned Parenthood has been trying to do for 100 years. And they finally stopped.
Every December, it's the time of year when we ask our supporters, partners, and our listeners to think about giving us a partnering donation at the end of the year as part of your year-end giving so that we can continue to bring you all of this great content from the Christian Research Journal, which, as you know, morphed from a paid subscription-based print magazine to online, and it's completely free. There is no paywall on our website whatsoever, and you get all the great content that you have continued to receive for more than 45 years from all of our contributing writers with the Christian Research Journal. So we're asking you to think about this partnering gift, and when you give one of these partnering gifts, you will receive the special issue. It's a collector's edition of the Christian Research Journal. It's called The War on Western Civilization. It's a themed issue. It's a double issue, so it's twice as long as our normal print issues, and you can get this as your gift when you give a partnering donation. Now, this is the last print issue ever, so we want you to be able to add this to your collection or just have it as a keepsake of almost 50 years of print publishing of the Christian Research Journal. So we are offering it in a variety of ways. You can get one copy, two copies, four copies, seven copies, or even a bundle of 10 copies. This would be a great equipping tool that would make a good Christmas gift for some of your fellow Christian apologists who are friends and family. So would you go on to our website, equip.org, and if you scroll down on the front page to gifts for your donation, you'll see a graphic there for the Christian Research Journal. You will see that last collector's issue cover, The War on Western Civilization, and if you click that, you can give us a partnering donation. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with us, including sometimes I know some of you have given us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. If you could do that, that's a way that you can partner with us. That's completely free except for the gift of your time. And we would be so thankful for that. So now back to my conversation with Jay Watts as we dig into the roots and history of Planned Parenthood.
We're talking about this op-ed by Alexis McGill Johnson. And actually, if people are searching for it, the exact title is "I'm the Head of Planned Parenthood. We're Done Making Excuses for Our Founder." And the subtitle is "We Must Reckon with Margaret Sanger's Association with White Supremacist Groups and Eugenics." McGill Johnson mentions experimenting on women in Puerto Rico in this piece. And so what happened in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, that to me is because I said it's over. These offenses happen over a period of time. And that's why I in the article I wrote, I listed 1916, 1923, 1925, 1927, as you work your way through these weird, so that you see that this was a period of time where things were consistently happening that demonstrated that this was somebody that just had a different view of human beings. The 1950s, we had like 1952, I think, is when. So you see, Margaret Sanger wants something better than what's going on with the diaphragm or the ways of birth control, the methods and manners of birth control that they have in their hands. And so she wants to develop something better. And so she starts talking to people about developing that. And one of the guys is by the name of Gregory Pincus, who specialized in mammal reproduction. And she asks him if his work could be used to create a cheap birth control pill. And he tries. And so they start developing it. And they have a philanthropist who underwrites this. And so now they have to experiment. And so they're trying to figure out where they can do experiments. But they can't do those experiments in places that will be seen or be visible. So Sanger and Pincus decide Puerto Rico is the perfect place. It's in the midst of a population boom. It has poverty. It meets every criteria of the group that they are aspirationally trying to reach as far as in her work, limiting the reproduction of these particular groups. And so they go down to Puerto Rico and they enlist something around 200 women to participate in experiment. But here's the thing. They don't tell them anything other than that if you take this pill, you won't get pregnant. They don't tell them this is new, that we've never done this, that you are the subject of trials. You're being experimented on. They don't explain that there's any negative side effects that could happen as a result of this. They don't have any concept, by the way, of what safe dosages are. And the dosages they're giving are many, many, some of them are like 20 times more powerful than what women take today. So which are measured doses that are intended to be specific to the needs of a woman today, that recognize the dangers inherent in taking anything that hormonally alters your body, which are things like blood clots, which happen to these women. They start having blood clot issues. Some of these women start suffering from severe depression. Three of the women die. There's no autopsy ever done to determine whether it was as a result of what was going on. The only result that they cared about was, did these women get pregnant? And they didn't. It did the one thing that they wanted it to do. It did all of these other negative things as well. And none of these women were given what we could seriously consider by any measure informed consent about what was going on. They were offered a pill. They were told it wouldn't get them pregnant. They were not informed of any of the risk. They were never informed that this was the first time anybody had ever taken. They were poor women on an island that had very little oversight and had the opportunity for them to come in and use them as the subjects of experiment. This is why minority groups oftentimes don't trust the medical establishment, because they've been used before as test subjects without informed consent or without any knowledge of what was going on. And so here we go again, right? Now, this is the 50s. This isn't 16. This isn't 23. This isn't 25. This isn't 27. We're in the 50s now. And Margaret Sanger is still showing her true colors. She simply doesn't care about certain classes of people, not enough to treat them as human beings. She's treating the women of Puerto Rico as guinea pigs so that she can then take whatever they learn from this and apply it back home and move this process forward. So yeah, I mean, this to me is just such a it's such a detestable thing to treat other human beings as test subjects. Every human being ought to be treated with dignity and respect. And when you see a whole class of people as somebody that I could take advantage of to advance some scientific cause or some sociological cause without explaining to them why we're using them, without telling them why they're suffering from depression, without telling them why they're suddenly getting blood clots, without even caring enough to find out if the three women who died while you were using them as test subjects died because of what you did to them, when all you cared about was did they get pregnant or not get pregnant, that's just vile. So yeah, I get Alexis McGill Johnson saying, we got to stop defending this person. It's got to end. We've got to stop acting like her offenses don't matter. We got to stop acting like there wasn't something corrupt at the beginning of what this organization was. But it centers on Margaret Sanger. It actually makes her a scapegoat too, right? If you just act like it was Margaret Sanger, you don't have to deal with the fact that this was institutional issues from the beginning.
This is kind of a side comment to this whole situation, that when you're talking about experimenting on people, but that seems to be like the MO of sometimes how things are developed, specifically these processes or drugs in particular. And I recently found out the history of the skincare product retinol, which is used for acne treatment and for anti-aging and everything like that. They first were testing all these things as chemicals to prisoners, So all these people who were getting burned by them, like severe burns, until they got the right chemical formulation up to make this medication. But when you think about it, it's just, so yes, it's helping a lot of teenagers with acne. It's helping, I guess, primarily women who use these anti-aging products, but the origins of it are pretty unsavory, in my opinion. So that can happen. And we just don't, you know, we haven't looked at history. We don't know what we're doing now and the origins of things like that. And speaking of that, you know, you talked about earlier in the podcast when we were talking about origins that it originally started as the American Birth Control League. And as I noted, Margaret Sanger's kind of, you know, focus was to help women not, as you know, said, be in a perpetual state of pregnancy based on seeing her mother do that, but also, you know, that they would have access, you know, sexual freedom and access to birth control. So how did this come, you know, start out as birth control, as providing access to more women to birth control, and then kind of morphed into a focus on abortion? Now, when they talk about what their organization does in terms of, oh, this is what we are doing. Basically, their tagline is they're the largest U.S. provider of reproductive health services, and they will list contraception. So they are still kind of promoting themselves as a key place, the largest place where you can get contraception, and they're not really focusing overtly that they do as many abortions as they do. So how did they make that shift?
Well, abortions become safer is one thing that happens. And as it's anytime we think of, one of the things I always try to encourage people when you think about history, right? And you go through an evaluation, it's easy to think what Planned Parenthood is now and project them back into the past. But that's not what happened. They began very small and centered around a very charismatic and passionate human being. And then they grew in increments. So in the 50s, as birth control is being sorted out, you also have a woman by the name of Dr. Mary Calderon come on as the first medical director of, at the time, Planned Parenthood becomes the name like 1942. They realize that birth control now has negative connotations that were offered from not just Nazi abuses, but also the early eugenics movement. Buck versus Bell, which I mentioned earlier, is a Supreme Court case that said it's okay to forcibly sterilize people in the United States. It's perfectly constitutional. That was never overturned, by the way. That's still precedent in the United States. It wasn't overturned because people saw the results of it and got uncomfortable with what was happening, both as what happened in the United States and then seeing Germany do it at its most robust form imaginable. And they said, and Nazism, and everybody sort of collectively said, that's not for us. That's not something we want to be involved in. And Margaret Sanger did not like abortion. That is true. She did not like it. And she saw birth control as the better option to abortion. Don't get pregnant is better than getting pregnant and destroying your child. And so she liked the idea of maintaining the identity of the organization on birth control. But the other people involved right now start to realize that birth control just is a negative view in the culture around them. And so they want to change it from birth control to family planning. And so that's where you get the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, the name. And so the transition towards abortion comes when you get Dr. Mary Calderon coming in as the medical director. She's in her 50s when she first becomes a doctor and starts working in this area. She is, she's an interesting woman in that she says in an interview about this, she says, you know, this was not the organization that people think of today. It was nothing. It was small. When I came on board, there was no man in the country that was going to take the job of medical director for Planned Parenthood. No medical professional was going to do that because it would have risked his reputation. But she said, it wasn't a problem for me. And then when Dr. Alan Guttmacher comes on in the early 60s, between those two, their work as Margaret Sanger's influence ends and theirs begins, they see abortion becoming safer. She actually argues this in a paper where she talks about the disease of illegal abortion. But what she doesn't mean is that it's still dangerous. She actually argues it's not dangerous anymore. It's being performed by medical professionals. We have antibiotic knowledge. We understand reproductive knowledge in a way, as far as a woman's reproductive system, in a way that we never have before. We're able of performing abortions safely. Most illegal abortions aren't dangerous. There aren't that many people dying of illegal abortions anymore. All that's happening is we're prosecuting doctors, and we're prosecuting and persecuting the very group that could make this all a public health thing and just something we're all doing out in the open. She's like, look, it's happening. It's happening in large numbers. Her estimates are ridiculous. She gives the conservative estimate, which is probably closest to correct, which is somewhere around 200,000 illegal abortions in the United States that year. But she gives it into a range up to 1.2 million illegal abortions in the United States, which is just absurd, because once abortion becomes legalized in 1973, I think the first year it goes up to like 700,000. So you wouldn't have or you know, decrease the number of abortions by 40% by making it legal. That's just not how the world works. So she says, okay, there's this massive number of them happening. They're not dangerous when they're done by a medical professional. Almost all the abortions are being done by medical professionals. This idea of the back alley abortion being dangerous and coat hangers, that was something that Mary Calderon says, that's a thing of the past. That's not happening anymore. Back alley abortions just by definition mean you enter the doctor's office through the back alley so nobody sees you coming, not that you're performing the abortion in the back alley. And so she makes this case that we need to develop relationships with the medical professional organizations, that family planning is an essential part of medical health care. And she and Dr. Alan Guttmacher work on this, and to great effect. And they have a lot of success doing that, transforming the way that we talk about abortion from it being a wrong thing that ought to be hidden and illegal to something embraced by the medical community that ought to be controlled by the doctors and access controlled by the medical professionals. This is not, by the way, it's interesting. The language or terms that they're using to legalize abortion isn't women's right and freedom to use their body however they want. The medical professionals that ultimately have the greatest influence are talking about it as an issue of medical access, that we should be allowed to decide what's right and wrong because we're the medical doctors and we understand the procedure that we're performing and we can do this safely to the woman. And so that's where you see the shift away from Margaret Sanger's vision of birth control being the primary way or the primary focus in the organization, to Calderon and Guttmacher starting to build this organization on the idea of alliances with medical professional organizations that can normalize abortion and that can stop the persecution or prosecution of abortion doctors, make this all happen out in the open because it's now safe. It's safe to perform abortions with medical doctors. Even illegal abortions are much safer than they've ever been in history.
I want to ask you a little bit about their more recent history, some significant things that have happened in the last decade or so. And one thing I want to ask you about is one of their former presidents, and Dr. Leanna Wen was the former health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. Actually, she was the health commissioner back in her 30s from 2014 to 2018. And she's also a former president of Planned Parenthood. So after she was the health commissioner in Baltimore, she moved on for less than 1 year, actually, to be the president of Planned Parenthood from September 2018 to July 2019. And not only that, Dr. Wen was the first female doctor to ever serve as the president of Planned Parenthood. But that's curious that her tenure wasn't even 1 year. So what happened with Dr. Wen's very short tenure as the president of Planned Parenthood?
She replaces Cecile Richards, who I think is one of the most powerful political people of the last century. I mean, Cecile Richards was just a political monster. And I mean that almost as a compliment. That woman was just able to get things done in the political spectrum. But one thing that did, we talked about the divisive nature of Planned Parenthood. And as they proudly bore the mantle of the face of abortion in the United States. And then they came under attack and people became uncomfortable with abortion, which happens. It ebbs and flows. Right now we're in a period where abortion is getting more support because people are reacting to the fall of Roe v. Wade. It ebbs and flows. The public goes back and forth on this. You have your intense people on either side, I being one of them on the pro-life side, other people representing it on the other side. And then the general public that works in the middle, they kind of vacillate back and forth between the two groups. They're not totally comfortable with either one of them. And so they think when one gets too much control, they seem to go back towards the other side. So as things go on one of those negative turns for the pro-choice side, Cecile Richards and the people behind Planned Parenthood start saying, well, abortion is only 3% of what we do. We offer 97% of the services we offer through Planned Parenthood have nothing to do with abortion. And it's actually helped. It's a great talk. You still hear it today from supporters of Planned Parenthood. It's still a talking point, even though it's been broadly debunked. It is still a talking point that gets traction with people. Oftentimes, the follow-up, it doesn't get anywhere near as much attention as the initial thing. The initial thing, the impact of that, it's only 3% of what we do, is so powerful that it's almost impossible to get it back, to corral it back, even when you explain that the way that they got there is fairly dishonest as far as a representation of what they're actually doing. So Leanna Wynn comes in, and she's sort of the anti-Cecile Richards, which I think they probably believed they needed at the time, because they were in one of their negative, they were in a negative period. They needed a fresh face. They needed a change. And Leanna Wynn does exactly what they say they have been doing over the last couple of years, defending themselves. She wants to make it a broader focus as far as the kind of health care that they're offering. And she wants to dial back the intensity on abortion, the intensity of the focus on abortion. And she does this. She starts putting pages on the website. She's also, it sounds like, somebody that is very used to having a high degree of control, which can happen when you come from a smaller place to a larger institution like that. You mentioned earlier, Planned Parenthood's huge. I mean, they're a massive institution, right? And so when you're used to a smaller organization, you move to a larger organization, you can suffer from the sense of needing control. There's some of that going on as well. But one of the main complaints they have was that she introduced what they called mission creep. So at the same time, they're running around telling everybody, we're not about abortion. And Leanna Wynn comes in and says, I agree, we're not all about abortion. I'm a medical doctor. Let's see what kind of medical services we can provide to the community and get them focused more on those positive things that we can offer our communities and less on this one thing that we do. She wasn't saying that we aren't about abortion anymore. She just wanted to make sure that the focus was less intensely placed on abortion and that Planned Parenthood was seen for all of the services they provide and even trying to expand in those areas and those services. And the board of directors says, that's mission creep. That's not who and what we are. You're losing sight of what the organization is. And long before she steps down, they were already negotiating her exit with her. And they appoint Alexis McGill Johnson, who is on the board of directors of Planned Parenthood. She is an activist. So she's more in their light, right? The best presidents of Planned Parenthood, as far as the people who are able to get done what Planned Parenthood wants done, seem to be activists. Fit Mergersinger was an activist. Faye Waddleton in the late 70s and 80s was an activist who took on the rise of the religious rights. Cecile Richards is this, you know, political power, this person that is unafraid to be hated, unafraid to be the enemy, that doesn't mind being the bad guy to the bad guys in their mind. So Leanna Wynn seems, you know, somewhat reasonable. And the last straw, by the way, according to, is that she published, I think it was the New York Times op-ed talking about her miscarriage. And that just seemed to, that was when it was over. Like, and you wonder, what was it, the humanizing language by the unborn that she's talking about? Was that the thing that sent them over? But that was when all negotiations ended and she had to be gone. Right? She talked about having had a miscarriage and the pain that she went through and the miscarriage publicly. And they said, okay, you've got to be gone. You got to be out. You're just not on board with our agenda. And their agenda is largely abortion. So that's one of the things I point out in the article, among other things, in debunking the 3%. The way that Planned Parenthood behaves demonstrates that abortion is more important to them than just 3% of the services. It's not just 3 versus 97. They are the face of abortion in the United States. And when Leanna Wynn wanted to take away from that intensity and sort of expand what they were known for, that Dr. Wynn was summarily dismissed and said, we need somebody back on the reins of Planned Parenthood there's an unapologetic activist who's going to be out there engaging and fighting and taking people on, not somebody who is going to be operating from sort of the kinder, gentler Planned Parenthood approach.
At the beginning of the podcast, you noted that Planned Parenthood has been the target of multiple sting operations. And some of the ones you mentioned, or the one that you mentioned, was planned by what some have characterized as more of a politically conservative organization. But you noted how in that, you know, example, how they were coaching some of the folks who were undercover. So these sting operations were planned over the years, not just by the example you gave, but by multiple organizations. So what are some of the charges that they have faced?
They have faced charges of being indifferent towards statutory rape. They've faced charges of aiding sex traffickers. They've faced charges of being an organization that aids abuse, that sexual abuse in families or the abuser, particularly older males, can bring young women in. They face charges of selling the remains of children that have been aborted for research purposes. They face charges of, these are just like the Planned Parenthood institutional charges, right? I mean, when you look at the abortion industry as a whole, I remember one time reading where C.S. Lewis talked about the truth bubbles up everywhere. Right. I mean, he said, because he was talking about it when somebody insulted Christianity by saying there were elements of Christian belief throughout mythical belief systems. And they saw that as a negative. And he said, I would think that if it were the truth, it should bubble up everywhere. And I think that's an interesting way to understand when you evaluate things. The truth of what somebody is. The Bible talks about that, right? I mean, it tells us to look for certain traits. If you read the book of James, it talks about, okay, well, people are talking this way. If they're using their tongue for slander or lying, if they're insulting people, Jesus says that anybody who calls his brother Raca murders his brother. I mean, you see these people, you see these warnings throughout the Bible, right? That the truth of what somebody is will bubble up in their behavior and their personality. It's not what they're saying they are. It's what their life demonstrates they are. Their works matter. Their works don't save them, but their works demonstrate to a large degree the character of the person inside of them. And I think the same thing is true of obvious institutions. And so all of these charges are being leveled by different groups, Live Edge, Center for Medical Progress, individuals who go in, they come up in lawsuits and they come up in criminal cases. I mentioned some of those earlier. We talked about these things that come up where they were brought up in a case of kidnapping across state lines, or brought up when the Center for Medical Progress caught them on video seemingly selling the remains. And their defense, again, is never, we didn't do it. The defense is you misunderstood what was happening, right? That what was happening, there's always nuance, there's always context, there's always explanation. But the truth of the matter is that they are just an organization that is committed to propagate and perform an act of evil. And as a result of that, you're going to see evil around them. Bad is going to percolate all around their operation. It's an interesting thing that you said. I remember somebody talking to me one time about how abortionists tend to be weird people. I said, well, of course they are. Look at what they do for a living. I mean, it's one thing for your neighbor to take a pro-choice position and say, I believe that women have a right to abortion, when they're not going to be performing abortions, when they're not going to be doing anything like that. It's another thing when you're the person that actually does those things, or you're the institution that actually does those things. Those are entirely different things. I remember watching Mike Adams debating Dr. Willie Parker, and it was a different kind of debate, because it wasn't like when I've gone to college campuses and debated people on the other side, or I've seen Scott Klusendorf debate people on the other side. This was debating somebody who was an abortionist, right? And who was providing abortions professionally as an act, as the way he made his money. And so Mike's response to him was different. So when you look at what happened there, as far as the stings and the things that people are trying, they're all trying to demonstrate that there's something weird going on in Planned Parenthood. And it happens year in and year out as people show that there's problems or issues that are going on. So, you know, the lack of success of those things has less to do with the lack of actual evidence that anything going on is wrong. It had to do with the tendency of people to believe their allies. So when Planned Parenthood said there's nothing to see here, they had the backing of everybody who loves Planned Parenthood to say, okay, there's nothing to see here, move on. And it came down into how the Center for Medical Progress, when they in Texas, when they were looking to the grand jury to see if they could prosecute Planned Parenthood for some of the offenses, the grand jury actually comes back and levels charges against David Delight and his partner for trying to buy medical waste, because it turns out that the prosecuting attorney or the attorney general was sharing information with Planned Parenthood and was corrupting the process of the investigation with the grand jury. It's weird the way that they escape over and over again, but it's also weird that you can find evidence for what they're doing wrong outside of the activist organizations that are seeing them, and it comes up in other places, academic articles, academic journals, investigations, criminal investigations. It just is there. There's something weird going on. But of course there would be, because the destruction of human life is evil. And when you've committed yourself to that principle as part of your organization, when that's key to the operating of your organization, when a major part of your organization is destroying life and lobbying for the ability to continue to destroy life, you would expect there to be evil in your organization. You would expect there to be corruption. You would expect there to be problems.
Well, one thing that Planned Parenthood always says that we've noted that really, you know, these kinds of attacks are trying to shut them down because they are actually really an indispensable provider for healthcare, particularly as we noted when Margaret Sanger started, the focus on poorer communities, communities in the inner city, that's where they have some of their clinics. And really, abortion services are only a small part of what they do. It's only 3% of actual birth control or contraception services, reproductive services that they offer. And that's the line that they give. And anytime you talk to, I think, just the person on the street that is somebody who supports Planned Parenthood, they will always say, well, that's something that people who are against abortion will always say, that they're about abortion. But really, what they are is about reproductive health, and abortions are really a small percentage of what they do. Does the statistics and the facts really affirm that they only do a small amount of abortion as their reproductive health services?
No. No, it does not. One of the defeater for that is the fact that, first of all, the way that they get that number 3% is they break out, they unbundle services. So let's say, for example, that a woman was going in to get an abortion. And as she's going in for that abortion, she's going to have to get an exam. She may have to get an ultrasound. She's going to have to get a birth control test. I mean, there'll be all of these things that happen as a result of her pursuing an abortion. Well, what Planned Parenthood will do to get to that 3% number is they'll say, look, we did this many pregnancy tests. We offered this many ultrasounds. We did this many exams. And all of these, if any of these were attached to the seeking of the abortion, they're not going to mention that. They've broken it out as different. These are different things that we've done. And so every time they can unbundle a service and say that we provided this service to a patient, we provided this servant to a patient. Anytime they can do that, they make that number that abortion represents smaller and smaller and smaller. It's not really, and Charlotte Lozier Institute does a good job of, when the annual budget comes out, they'll do a talking point response to Planned Parenthood's annual report. And they've pointed out for years now, all of the other services that Planned Parenthood are having are decreasing. For a group to go around and say, we're about so much more and we're expanding our coverage and we're doing all of this and we represent, the abortion is growing. Abortion continues to grow as a percentage of what they do. And all of the other services that they claim are so important or central to what they're doing, they're actually doing less, and they're seeing fewer people, providing fewer of those services, doing fewer breast exams. All of those services continue to decrease over the years as the abortion continues to increase. So the idea that it's just a small part of what they do, when they expend so much money lobbying for abortion access, when they make so much money off of it, when they put themselves out there online as the great defenders of abortion, as the force that's fighting back against the group that destroyed Roe v. Wade, as they are defending the rights of women, then the idea that they're going to marginalize it and say, but we're not all about abortion, is not there. You're not all about abortion, but you're doing less and less of everything else, almost, for the most part. There's other habits. I mean, they're doing more with the trans community, but they're doing fewer and fewer of these things that they say are central to their mission of providing healthcare. But their influence in abortion continues to grow and expand, and the number of abortions that they're getting is at least staying steady, and in some cases rising here and there from year to year. So no, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever to say that they are comprehensive health care providers and they're doing all of these other things, when the main, everybody knows the main focus of what they're doing for, and some of those, the charges that people actually will levy against them as far as why they do some of those other things are about relationship building with people so that they'll be comfortable with them. I've heard people, by the way, not with Planned Parenthood, but people with Huffington Post talk about this. A friend of mine went to years ago, he worked with a conservative group, used to go to these liberal media conferences where they would discuss how they were using social media and media to be able to build relationships with the next generation. And that was one of the things that they said, by providing all of these other services, we make ourselves trusted so that when they need the big things, that they'll feel comfortable coming to us. You actually see this offered, by the way, now by pregnancy resource centers that offer things like STD testing and that offer things outside of abortion services for the very same reason, because they say we want them to trust us. We want them to develop a habit of coming to us. We want them to know that we are going to tend to their care beyond just this moment of crisis, so that when the moment of crisis comes, they'll feel comfortable coming to us. It's a lot of the other services are provided by Planned Parenthood operate the same way there. But the center of what they do, the center of what they fight for, the center of their public advocacy, the area that's growing all the time, the area that never shrinks, never backs down, is abortion. And they do less and less of everything else all the time.
Well, I want to ask you, just briefly mention the word trans in your last article. I just want to ask you a little bit about something that Johnson said in her New York Times op-ed piece, and I thought this was very interesting that Alexa McGill Johnson wrote this, and she wrote this, quote, "And sometimes that's how Planned Parenthood has acted. By privileging whiteness, we've contributed to America harming Black women and other women of color, and when we focus too narrowly on, quote, women's health, end quote, we have excluded trans and non-binary people." So I think that's really interesting. I think they've been accused of in the past not being as active in the LGBTQ community, in particular as it relates to trans people. And so what are the specific criticisms that Planned Parenthood is responding to? I also want to tell our listeners that earlier this year, we kind of dealt with that whole issue around even saying, you know, I just said she's called it, quote unquote, you know, air quotes, women's health. We had an article and a podcast. It was episode number 377 around the whole idea of what the meaning of the word woman is. And so that podcast and article available on our website, equip.org, is called What Happened to the Word Woman. But what are the specific criticisms that they are responding to in terms of Johnson acknowledging that they have not been as pro-trans and non-binary as they should be?
You know, everybody is in a point right now where we're being told to reevaluate our language. And so you tend to see conservative people reject that idea, and you tend to see people who would fall into progressive circles embracing that idea. It's respectful to reevaluate the way that we use our language. This is where it gets interesting for Planned Parenthood. I mean, Planned Parenthood has existed since 1916 in some form or another, some continuous operational form, as a service to women to control their birth, to free up them up sexually to make decisions, to stop the burden of constantly being pregnant, to make it so that they're equal or on equal grounds with men. I mean, there's been an element to this talk all along that has been about giving women reproductive freedom that has been enjoyed by men all along by virtue of just the biological differences between men and women. And then you get complaints there was an open letter to Planned Parenthood that was published from the trans community and the Rewire News Group from the trans community to Planned Parenthood and from marginalized community. They're looking more for that idea of feminism that is no longer the feminism, this woman-centered in the sense, but this new idea of feminism that's incorporating or allowing all sorts of different groups to be under the umbrella of women, which you've seen just have some interesting side effects in some of the traditional women colleges up in the Northeast. But to that end, what they've said is the traditional language of pro-choice and women's rights is exclusionary. When you say that it's pro-choice, you're being exclusive, you're excluding a whole bunch of people that need the advocacy of Planned Parenthood in their lives. Women who can get pregnant and choose to get abortions. That's all women-centered. So get away from this concept of pro-choice. Get away from this idea of women's and family planning. And let's embrace the view of reproductive justice. They said reproductive justice includes everybody. It includes the trans community. It includes the LGBTQ community. It includes people who can't get pregnant. Or people who are making different choices. It includes everyone. So they said, get away from the exclusive language of pro-choice and women's rights and get into the language of reproductive justice. And that will be the more exclusive term. And you've seen them. That was the study. At the same act, it's interesting to me. I mentioned earlier that I actually think Alexis McGill Johnson's denouncing Margaret Sanger was good leadership. But I think at the same time, then it's you give and you take away. You do a great job there. And then all of a sudden you introduce this at the end because now you're getting away from what you are, right? I mean, in the sense that you have a group that has come to you now and said, you have to stop talking in terms of women's rights and pro-choice, and you have to embrace language that is inclusive to all groups that can enjoy the advocacy of Planned Parenthood, that we see you as a progressive force for sexual wellness and reproductive wellness in the culture, but you have to embrace everything that means in the modern terminology. And that means that you cannot use this sort of binary language or understanding of what you are any longer, and have to embrace terminology that accepts and embraces everyone into your advocacy efforts, and then become the service provider for them as well. And she does that to the point that she even identifies the new, a new enemy for Planned Parenthood, which would be trans exclusionary radical. Yeah,
they're feminists, yeah, that are anti what they would describe as anti-trans.
Yeah, they believe that being a biological woman matters, that there's something about that that's important, and that you can't just say anyone's a woman by virtue of how they feel or their emotional condition or their psychological condition, which would be J.K. Rowling being the most famous of the trans exclusionary radical feminists on the planet right now, because she's critical of people being able to say that anyone is a woman, because she says, and that means the term woman has become meaningless, and that people like her fought too long for women to have protections and rights to then have anybody who wants to be able to call themselves a woman. She doesn't have any problem with trans people living their lives or making decisions they want as far as they live. She just doesn't like the co-opting of the word woman, and that women losing all of the spaces of safety that they would have reserved for women because just anybody can now identify themselves as a woman. That is now identified as a trans exclusionary radical feminist, which Alexis McGill Johnson now identifies as an enemy to Planned Parenthood's new vision of reproductive justice.
So you're talking about how they're trying to expand their services and so forth to some of these, what they would characterize as marginalized communities, the trans communities. Have they increased their services to the trans community, and what kind of services are they offering to them?
They have, as of the last annual report, I think 41 of 49 now of their affiliates are providing hormonal treatment to the trans community, including, you know, the hormone therapy for those who wish to transition, and including puberty blockers for those who wish to hold back. They have videos online that are promoting these ideas. I think, you know, they talk about puberty blockers as simply a stop sign. It is just a stop sign so that you can stop the changes in your body for a moment, decide whether you want to continue on with them or whether you want to transition. So it became even to the point that, like, when Planned Parenthood was losing support in particular states after the fall of Roe v. Wade, I believe Tennessee was one where this is true. And NPR wrote an article about how one of the big disasters that has happened as a result of Planned Parenthood not being able to operate functionally in Tennessee because they're losing state funding, and because of the laws against abortion that are being passed or supported, is that also the trans community is losing their ability to access hormone therapy and puberty blockers from that said, so they need these people. They have this is an ongoing, like, abortion is a crisis moment. It comes and it goes. But if you're getting hormonal treatment for transition from in that sense, from a man to a trans woman, then you have to have that continuously. That's something that you have to be able to get on an ongoing basis. It doesn't come and go in crisis moments like an abortion does. It's a constant need, a constant supply issue that you're going to have, and you have to have reliable treaters. And so they come out and say the problem with that we're going to lose if we lose abortion is also support for the trans community, because they need Planned Parenthood there to give them their medication if they begin to trust them on this hormone block. So yes, they have increased. It is one of the few things growing in Planned Parenthood outside of abortion is their treatment, hormone therapy, and puberty blocker treatment for young people in the trans community.
Well, I want to ask you just kind of to wrap up our conversation about their history. So does this new focus and new language that they're trying to accommodate all kinds of people, like we noted that Johnson was talking about in her op-ed, that, you know, they want to be more inclusive. In other words, it's too narrow to be focused on quote unquote women's health. But yet at the same time, you said that they are providing a ton of abortions, way more than the 3% that they claim. So is this a different change of focus if they're providing hormone blockers? And I don't know if Jay mentioned this, but he did in his article that they've been giving these services to the trans community since 2015, which is a really long time. I thought it would have been more recent, but they have been doing that. Of course, it's much more widespread in all their affiliates now. But is this a new focus for them?
I think it is. And I think it's dangerous. Not that I'm worried about Planned Parenthood. I don't sit around worried that Planned Parenthood is making bad decisions. But when I went during this long period of looking at them and researching them and reading about them and checking as many different sources as I could and pro for and against the con, what you found out is that I think Planned Parenthood has done very well by having a very clear message, right? They clearly represent a viewpoint in the world, or have for a very long time. They very clearly represent a worldview. They very clearly represent a view of sexual wellness. They very clearly represent a view of abortion. They very clearly represent a view of total health. I mean, these are things that they are very clear representatives of the point of view of sex from the progressive side, right? And I'm not sure that's true anymore, because when you say feminist, even a small group of feminists or a large group of feminists, when you say feminists are now our enemies, or a group of feminists, or some people identify themselves as feminists are now our enemies, you have suddenly put yourself in a position where you're defending something else. I mentioned that earlier where I said that I think it's always bad when you're an organization that has a clear mission statement for any organization to take on something. And I mentioned Margaret Sanger was that something for Planned Parenthood, where they had two jobs. We have to serve our mission and we have to defend Margaret Sanger. By Alexis McGill Johnson doing that op-ed, by removing her name from things, by recognizing the evil of her past, they no longer have to have the job of defending Margaret Sanger. They take that off of their to-do list, which is a nice thing to do. Get focused on your mission statement. Even if I don't like you, it makes sense, right? So here's the same thing, right? Well, now Planned Parenthood, which is the face of abortion in the United States, is the face of women's rights and access to abortion, the largest lobbyer as far as spending money to affect abortion law, the largest single provider of abortions, doing almost 40% of abortions reported in the United States. Suddenly, you see their name in articles, not defending women's access to abortion, not fighting against abortion laws, not doing any of those things, but for the weird way that they're dealing with the trans community and the heat that they're getting from that and the videos they're producing from that and the literature that they're trying to get into schools on that. And for them, their response is, well, of course, this is a stigmatized treatment. Abortion's a stigmatized treatment. Treatment for trans is a stigmatized treatment. So we are just offering in bravery the things that other people don't want to do, things that other people don't want to talk about. But it opens up the opportunity for confusion. In one of the articles that I did post, it was a woman who works in the trans community who helps provide hormone treatment. And she says, look, I'm pro-choice. I am pro-trans. I'm down with all this. I just can't figure out what Planned Parenthood has to do with this. And it makes me wonder if they know what they're doing. And there's fears that are expressed from people that work in that. What they say that we don't want people who are looking to get reliable treatment and help in these areas to go to Planned Parenthood because we won't trust them with this. And you see this distrust, not just from the outside or from their opponents who look at this and say, what are you doing, right? They're getting into this now. Why has this become something that you want to fight over? Just yet another part of the culture war, another thing to try to undermine traditional values, another way that you're attacking the traditional view of identity and sex and humanity and all of these things. You will see it from the other side who are saying, I agree with you in principle on the things that you've always done, but now your new messaging is confusing me. And I mentioned a quote from The Sun Also Rises in the article that I think when I said there's no immediate danger, because right now this is a very popular position to take. Right now with the progressive side being very trans affirming is a popular place to be, but that's a very soup du jour moment, right? I mean, that is the day. That is the trend of the moment. And to transition so much of your, with, you know, no pun intended, transition so much of your stuff towards a new thing like that represents dangers. And the quote I mentioned from The Sun Also Rises is when a character in that book is asked how he went bankrupt, his response, I think, is interesting. He says, gradually, it says two ways, gradually, then suddenly. And I was talking to a guy recently who runs major organizations and political organizations, and we were discussing what happens when you get mission creep, or where you get off mission, or where you start to try to muddy up the clarity of what your message has always been. And he pointed to that too. We were talking. He said that gradually and suddenly thing, it's a thing to watch out for, right? It's little things start to unravel a little bit here and there, and then suddenly it reaches a tipping point where you've lost control of things. And I think that it's interesting to see an enduring, powerful, large entity, popular across the board with celebrities and corporations, with such a powerful voice, going so strongly in that direction that at the very same time Alexis McGill Johnson is uncoupling herself from one problem, she is actively coupling themselves to a whole new thing that could be a problem with messaging in the future. Because if you go and watch their stuff, it does get more confusing the longer you get. Like, the closer you get to modern videos, it just becomes a mishmash of everything. They become a talking point for everything. They're trying so hard to push every progressive agenda on sex in one little spot that it becomes difficult to parse through what their point is, other than everything's acceptable, which is kind of the point that they're trying to make. Sexually, if you have consent, everything's acceptable. There's nothing bad. It's all a free-for-all. That's far from the very focused beginning of Margaret Sanger. However you feel about her, she was about birth control. And then even early on, as you get, it's very, the very focused approach of birth control and abortion. It's just getting, it's just hard for, when you start to lose focus as an organization to champion everything. And that's what I see more now. They're transitioning into these things. They're branching out to these things. They're offering more services. And at the same time, they seem to be getting confusing to watch.
Well, on a much lighter note than Planned Parenthood and all of its activities, I have a fun rapid fire question for Jay. So we're heading into the holiday season. Does your family have a favorite tradition that you serve a particular dish at your Christmas dinner that you enjoy?
Okay. I grew up in my family where my mom would make steak and scrambled eggs and hash browns on Christmas morning every year. And my family is trying, I've been trying mightily to make that our morning as well. So we try to do steak and hash browns and scrambled eggs on Christmas morning before we go do other things. And we're having to fit it in different places because of the way our celebrations go with other parts of the family. But that, to me, it may sound weird because it's just what my mom did. And I have no idea why my mom always did it, but I loved it. And that was Christmas morning to me, was a breakfast of steak and hash browns and scrambled eggs. It was just lovely. So I'm trying to get that in with my family more and more. They love it. It's just getting it in that's hard.
Well, that sounds delicious. Thanks, Jay, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to episode 369 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest, Jay Watts, has written an in-depth online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called The Roots of Planned Parenthood. And you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to
Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.